Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
And joining us for a look this week at science and the wondrous world that it contains is Charlie Limeweaver. Charlie, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Well, good evening and welcome to the contained world of science.
Yes, well, let's try and uncontain some bits of it. The Nobel Prizes are always interesting. Now, the one for physics, which would interest you a lot, Charlie, didn't go to you this year, but let's keep hoping. But it did. It did go to Roger Penrose. Now, he's the guy, with others, who nutted out the proof that black holes existed. But mind you, he did his work back in the middle 60s, I think, wasn't it? I mean, heaven's sake, why has it taken so long for him to get the prize?
I didn't know you followed this topic so closely, Phil. You know an awful lot about this. Roger Penrose has been working on black holes, and specifically, in the 60s and the 70s, with Stephen Hawking.
Yes.
And they came up with what they were very interested in was the singularity, particularly in the beginning of the universe. But basically, they worked on theory that said, yes, there will be black holes. And you may not know this, but in the 60s, quasars were discovered. These are very, very bright, very, very distant. And people said, what in the world are these things? And then Roger Penrose and others said, they are black holes. And that's their current explanation as well. So Roger Penrose is somebody who's got a very clear mind. He's a topological mathematician, and he was able to apply topology to general relativity. And that's why, with Stephen Hawking, he made so many contributions to black hole theory. And also, if you're interested, entropy. I'm very interested in entropy, and Roger Penrose has also written about that. So I really recommend he's a very good writer, and he's written probably at least half a dozen books of popular science, so please go out and read some of his.
How old is he now? He must be very...
He must be pushing 80, I think, 75. Yeah. I talked to him a few years ago, and his mind is perfectly clear, so it's always as good as it was.
Wow. Here he is, very end of his life, gets a Nobel Prize.
I should say he got half the Nobel Prize in physics for theoretical work on black holes. The other half was won by Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Goetz. Andrea Goetz, she's at the UCLA, and Genzel is in Germany, and these are observers. These guys love using the largest telescopes, sophisticated instrumentation, and they got the Nobel Prize for looking at the black hole in the center of our galaxy and determining what its mass was, and looking at all the stars. They're very weird Wolf-Rayet-type stars. That's a specific type of very massive star, very bright, that is in orbit around the central mass black hole. And that sounds like it's easy to describe, but it's very hard to see because the black hole in the center of our galaxy, you have to look through the plane of the galaxy. There's all kinds of other stars and dust between us and the central black hole. So they had to look through all that. You can't look through in the optical. You have to use infrared, and you have to use special techniques like speckle imaging and adaptive optics to look through all that junk. And that's why they got the Nobel Prize, because they were able to do it and measure the speeds of the stars going around the black hole and therefore measure the mass of the black hole.
Okay. Now, moving on from Nobel Prizes for a bit, what about this question, which it sounds interesting to me. Does sound, like light, have a maximum speed? Now, we know that the speed of light is a constant. You can't go faster than the speed of light. And let's not go into it right now, but just accept that you can't, because the maths and the physics are against you. But could sound go that far? I mean, sound, as we know, travels much more slowly. But does it have a maximum speed?
Well, when you look at lightning and you see lightning, and it takes a few seconds for the thunder to hear thunder, so you know that the speed of sound is slower than the speed of light. And when you measure this, as a matter of fact, I had students measure this in my planetary science class last week, and you can measure this, and it's about 330 meters per second in air. But in water, it's much faster. And in steel, you take a steel pipe and hit it with a hammer, it's much faster still. So you say, well, how fast? Is there a maximum limit to this?
Yeah.
And these guys, these physicists, said that's the question they went out to answer. And they had some theory, and they tested it in high-pressure stuff. And one of the things they figured out was, if you have, let's say, metallic iron and metallic hydrogen, so metallic iron is much the atom is, the nucleus is bigger, it's more massive. And they figured out that if you have hydrogen, which only has a proton in the center, and iron, which has like 52 or 53 nucleons in the center, that it's more massive, and therefore sound travels more slowly through metallic metal, the iron, than it does through metallic hydrogen. So they figured, hey, the fastest sound in the universe will be through the metallic hydrogen in near the core of Jupiter.
Right.
So anyway, they were able to make some predictions, and they were able to test those predictions, and those predictions for the first time gave a maximum speed limit, and here it is, drum roll, 36 kilometers per second is the estimated maximum speed of sound, and that's something like 10 times faster than the speed of sound in the air that we're talking right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, take that back, 100 times, because it's 36,000 meters per second and as compared to 300 meters per second. So that's 100 times faster.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Now, how about this? Stone Age people in Ireland had dark skin and were lactose intolerant. How do we know that?
Well, how do you think we know that, Phil?
Why didn't they have red hair and freckles like we know they're supposed to have?
Well, this new result is based on some human bones that were found in a cave in Northwest Ireland. And they took these bones and they drilled into them and found some DNA that was still intact. And they were able to sequence the DNA, as you do. And when you sequence human DNA, you can tell, well, there are certain genes that control the color of your skin. And the genes that they looked at in this particular sample from about 4,000 or 5,000, this is the Stone Age, years ago, and they had darker skin than the current Irish population. Mm-hmm. And they're also lactose intolerant. That all you have to do is look at some genes that control whether you as an adult can tolerate lactose, yes or no. You notice that that didn't exist much in this population at that time. However, later on, when your people around you started keeping cows and drinking milk as adults, you have to be lactose tolerant. And you and I are probably lactose tolerant because of our ancestors over the past 5,000 years. But if you look back 5,000 years ago, most of the population living in Europe was not, because there weren't that many cows providing milk to keep people alive.
No. It's a great discovery, this, isn't it? Where these bones were found, they were discovered accidentally by a bushwalker. Well,
yes.
Bushwalker,
yes.
Like a rambler. And
yes.
He was rambling over a mountain, and he actually accidentally discovered this chamber, which had been not disturbed, they think, for maybe 5,000 years.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Well, that is pretty cool, and it had been disturbed by people. See, what they used to do is when somebody died, they'd bring them into this cave, and I guess the critters, rodents and things, would come eat the flesh off of it, of the body, and then they would move the important bigger bones to somewhere else, and they left a few other ones, and the few other ones are the ones that were tested for this result.
Mm. Yeah. Now, we know that birds can fly long distances. But how about this? The bar-tailed godwit has broken a world record for non-stop bird flight. It's flown more than 12,000 kilometres from Alaska to New Zealand in 11 days. Really? That's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, it is. And this is something that because we have such miniaturized tracking devices now, small birds like this, and I think that anywhere from 200 to 400 grams these birds are, and they attach a 5-gram tracker on them, and then they just watch the thing on Google Maps, and they see it moving about 55 kilometers an hour, and 11 days. Now they know that it also that it didn't land, because there aren't that many islands in the middle of the Pacific between Alaska.
Well, so it stayed aloft for 11 days.
Apparently, I'm not quite sure that it might have landed in New Caledonia on the way there, but I'm not quite sure of that detail. But the problem is, how in the world? I mean, humans die, I think, if you don't sleep for like 2 or 3 days. It's almost, sleep is more important than water, I think, in some way. So how do these birds do that? Maybe they're, horses can sleep when they're standing up. Maybe birds astronauts can sleep while they're flying. But in the article that I read, it said that they are not sleeping. But I don't think they had an EEG, an electroencephalogram, attached to their brains to figure out whether they were or not sleeping. So I'm not quite sure how they had the right to say that.
It's an extraordinary thing. If this small bird, it flew over the open ocean for days and days on end in the middle of the Pacific, where there's no land, and navigated its way all the way to New Zealand. It's unbelievable, really.
A lot of migratory birds have really severe adaptations. Like I read that this godwit, they can double the weight of their body before they engage in this 11-day flight, because they're not eating either, right? They're probably not sleeping, and they're definitely not eating. Well, these are things that you learn, that you get adapted to. You can imagine that, I don't know, 10,000 years ago, maybe they only flew 5,000 kilometers, and then, I don't know, Alaska is not getting closer to New Zealand.
No, exactly. Well, here's the thing. Apparently, these birds turn around and fly back again to Alaska.
Well, as you do when you're migratory birds, right? The whole point is to go somewhere with lots of food, and then you can get fat and breed. And then, I guess, I mean, a lot of people do this too. I mean, starting to do this, they say, hey, I only like summer, therefore I'm going to go to the Northern Hemisphere in June, July, and August, and the Southern Hemisphere in January, February. So you have a permanent summer, right?
Mm. Staying with the natural world, there is some rewilding news. The Tasmanian devil, which is, of course, a much-loved animal in Tassie, our only carnivorous marsupial, has been reintroduced to mainland Australia.
Yeah,
it used to be on mainland Australia, but not for 3,000 years. Outcompeted by probably dingoes. But dingoes, of course, have never been in Tasmania, so the devil survived.
Right, that's what we think happens. So the Tasmanian devils used to be on mainland Australia about 3,000 years ago, and then because the way the dingoes, I guess maybe they hunt in packs or something, they were able to outcompete and kill the Tasmanian devils. But now there's an Aussie ARC is an organization that has decided to reintroduce Tasmanian devils to mainland Australia, and they're starting with 26, and these 26 have been vetted to make sure they don't have this terrible transmissible facial cancer that has wiped out about 90% of the Tasmanian devils in Tasmania. So I think one of the motivations for this is to try to get populations that are free from this terrible cancer. And if perchance the facial cancer wipes out the Tasmanian devils in Tasmania, there would be another population where it could still survive. And we will not be responsible for another species going extinct, but rather preparing or preserving a species from going extinct. And that's kind of the way we want to go. I mean, if you listen to David Attenborough, we need to rewild the planet and keep wild spaces open. And this is certainly one of the advantages where you can keep species that otherwise would go extinct from going extinct. I don't know if you want to go to make mammoths come back or make T-Rex come back, but that's maybe another more controversial thing.
That's a controversial one, isn't it? Yes. I mean, but mammoths, of course, are relatively recent, aren't they? I mean, there seems, in a way, no reason why they couldn't come back.
I think humans are responsible for killing a lot of megafauna, and yeah. Mammoths are only, I guess they died out maybe on the order of 10 or 12,000 years ago. But and DNA from 12,000 years is certainly recoverable. I'm not sure what type of species, whether you'd use an African or a Indian elephant as the birth mother for the first mammoth. Maybe you'd have to make a hybrid between an elephant and a mammoth, and then that hybrid could then be, I guess, be the birth mother for another mammoth, and so you'd have to work it into the population in that way. But T-Rex is another issue. I don't think we don't have T.
We don't have enough DNA to get that to bring back T-Rex.
Not yet, Phil.
We don't want to bring back T-Rex anymore.
Some people would, I think. And how about the thylacine? That's another issue that I know of.
That's a much-loved thing for Tasmanians, yes. The thylacine, of course, I think the last one died in the 1930s. So
1933 in a zoo in Tasmania. I think it was
right.
In Hobart.
That's right. But so that's ever eminently recoverable, you would think.
Well, you should feel responsible if you kill it. I mean, humans definitely killed them, made it go extinct.
Yeah.
The sheep farmers and... And maybe we should bring it back. Michael Archer, my colleague, is definitely on that side, and they've been trying, and apparently it's doable. I'm not sure why they haven't done it yet, but I think they're getting close.
Yeah, well, if it's doable, I think they should do it. I mean, it's as I say, it's not as though it's thousands of years ago or wasn't native to the landscape. It was. So, yeah, if they could do it, it'd be a wonderful rewilding thing, you would think.
I bet you're not a cat owner, Phil, because one of the things about Tasmanian devils is they will probably not do good for feral cats or foxes. I mean, they will probably kill a lot of them or outcompete them, and that's one of the supposedly positive effects of bringing back Tasmanian devils. Yeah. And presumably also the thylacine, because these are predators, kind of like foxes and feral cats.
Well, anything that gets rid of feral cats and foxes would be very welcome. All right. Terrific, Charlie, as always. Thank you.
You're welcome, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.